Thank you for listening to the Crossroads Christian Church podcast. Crossroads is a multicultural gospel-centered church serving the Bay Ridge and Sunset Park neighborhoods of Brooklyn, New York. If you would like to learn more about our faith community, please visit crossroadsbrooklyn.com.
Aristotle, the great philosopher, he believed that one can have anything and everything in this life, but without a friend, one is lacking, he said. Excuse me. I'll pull that up. Aristotle said that in poverty and other misfortunes of life, it is true friends who are a sure refuge. They keep the young out of mischief, they comfort and aid the old in their weaknesses, and they incite those in the prime of their life to noble deeds. That's what friends do. Charles Dickens famously quipped, he said, "Friendship? Yes, please." Friendship is something that we all want and something we all know is good. Our hearts tell us that friendship is good and necessary. The great philosophers, Aristotle, the great storytellers, Charles Dickens, all know this. But science also backs it up. Friendship is vitally important. Tom Rath of the Gallup organization conducted research on the importance of friendship. And he said that if your friends, the people that you hang, that you spend most of your time with, if they eat healthy, you are 5 times more likely to develop a healthy diet yourself. Okay? Which means you probably don't want to be friends with me. Because I can eat what I want, stay skinny, and I'm a bad influence. Married people, a research of married couples, say that friendship is 5 times more important than sexual intimacy in a relationship. So friendship within a marriage nearly secures that a relationship will be sustained for the long run. So scientific research says, if you don't want a divorce, be friends with each other. Be friends. Those who say that they have no real friends at work have only a 1 in 12 chance of feeling fulfilled and engaged at their job, while those who claim they have a, quote, best friend at work are 7 times more likely to feel engaged and be successful in their jobs, which leads to better promotion and better earning opportunities. And here we are, we live in New York City, and it's easy to think that because we live in a city this large, 8.5 million people, that friendship is not something, that making friends would be easy. But anybody who's lived here for a while knows that the larger the city sometimes, the more alone you can feel. A few years ago, Olivia Lang wrote a book about New York called The Lonely City. And in this book, she points out that there is an actual phenomenon called urban loneliness. And that is that the more people in an area, the more you are actually overlooked. And the more people in an area, the more you blend in and people don't notice you. And as a result, it's actually more difficult to develop and cultivate deep relationships in large cities, particularly New York. Jim Croce, who is one of my favorite songwriters of all time, a Pennsylvania boy who came and moved to New York City to make it as a musician, and he says in his song, in one of his songs, he says, "Though all the streets are crowded, there's something strange about it. I've lived here a year and I've never once felt at home." And in the chorus, and I'm not going to sing it, though I like singing it, he says, because you know that I got to get out of here. I'm so alone. Don't you know that I got to get out of here because New York's not my home, because he was so lonely. And many people in our city feel this way, lonely, without a friend. And if you want to make it here, people think that you need to excel at your job and you need to be at the top of your field. But the reality is if you want to make it here and you want this big city to be home, you've got to be connected to other people. You've got to be connected to friends. So friendship is deeply, deeply important. And friendship is the theme of the passage that we're looking at today. So if you look with me in 1 Samuel chapter 18, we're going to cover chapters 18 through 20, but we're going to dig into the first little bit of chapter 18. And so we'll start with this first little section, and then I'll fill in the narrative as we go. It says in chapter 18, verse 1, it says, "As soon as David had finished speaking to Saul, The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of his robe that was on him, and he gave it to David. He stripped himself of his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul sent him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. In verse 6, it says, as they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, meaning Goliath, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, and they were singing and dancing to meet King Saul. They had tambourines with songs of joy and musical instruments, and the women sang to one another as they celebrated. And this is the song they sang. Saul has struck down his thousands, but David his 10,000s. So the song was about essentially how much better of a warrior David was than Saul. And it says, Saul got very angry, and this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on and wanted to murder him. And so the background of this passage is that the story picks up after David defeats Goliath. And David is brought into Saul's court, King Saul's court, and he's speaking with Saul, and he meets Jonathan. And Jonathan is Saul's son. And David and Jonathan kind of become fast friends. They become close friends very quickly. And they make a covenant with one another that they're friends and that they are committing to one another, a friendship. And some ladies then come up to King Saul and they start singing, Saul has slain thousands, but David has slain his 10,000s. And Saul realizes in this moment that David is way more popular than him. Even though Saul is the king, he realizes that David is much, much more popular than him. And so he becomes angry and envious and jealous and murderous. And if you read from 18 to 20 and then on through 1 Samuel, you find out that there are 6 murder attempts that Saul sort of tries to kill David. There's 6 times where he tries to kill him. And sometimes it's as simple as he tries to throw a spear at him. Other times he gets really creative and sends David on suicide missions. Sort of like he crafts up these missions that he sends David on, thinking surely David won't succeed and he'll die. And David always comes back and wins because the Lord was with him. And the whole time, David, you know, he's a man after God's own heart. He's a good man. He's got a good heart. And all the time, he's not trying to like get back at Saul. He's simply trying to mend this relationship. And so David is living in Saul's house, plays music for him every night, and is trying to like figure out how to mend this relationship. But meanwhile, Saul's trying to kill him all the while, and you wonder, how is David able to survive? And as you read through these chapters, you find out that the reason that David was able to survive is because Jonathan, Saul's son, is a friend to David and constantly protects him. So he's always one step ahead of his father and is always protecting David, always trying to help David run from his father. He eventually helps David escape the city and escape the watchful eye of Saul. And the story in chapter 20 ends just like it begins, where Jonathan protects David and confirms his friendship with him, confirms his covenant, and then they confirm that, their friendship. And so this is a story about friendship, but it points beyond simply David and Jonathan and their friendship. It points us to the love of God. And we can apply this story in 3 ways to our lives. I kind of want to work it in 3 areas of our lives that I want to apply this story. First is applying it to our friendships, applying it to our understanding of the church, and then using it to allowing this story to help us understand more of Jesus. So the first thing is the importance of friendship. Friendship is important. See, the story of David's struggle for his life is bracketed by his friendship with Jonathan. It begins with Jonathan, and then in the end, it's Jonathan that protects him from Saul. And without this friendship, David never would have survived the murderous sort of assaults and attacks of Saul. Without Jonathan, David probably never would have been king, because he wouldn't have lived to see that day. And without friendship, neither can we survive all the arrows that life throws at us. We can't survive this city without friendship. We can't survive this city without one another. And there's 2 things I want you to see about friendship from this passage. First, is that friendship is rooted in the character of God. See, in Genesis 1 and 2, there's this pattern of God's creation. God creates the heavens and the earth. It's good. God creates the animals. He creates the land. He creates the sea. It's good. He creates light. He creates darkness. It's good. It's good. It's good. And then there's this break in the rhythm that disrupts the poetry. So Genesis 1 and 2 is like a poem. God creates this on the first day, and it's good. God creates this on the second day. It's good. And then all of a sudden, there's this interesting thing that happens that breaks the rhythm, and it says that David was alone, and it says that it's not good that he should be alone. And anybody who would have understood Hebrew poetry reading this would have noticed that. Good, 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 very good when he talks about the creation of Adam. But then there's this moment where he says, but it's not good that man should be alone. And so God creates from Adam, Eve, a friend, a spouse, a partner. And if you think about this, Adam was in paradise. He was in perfect shalom with both God, perfect peace with God and creation. And God says, something about this is not good. You need a friend. You need someone to share all of this with. See, God created you. He created me for relationships. That's why it wasn't good that Adam was alone. God created you to need relationships. And some of you may think that loneliness is a sign of weakness. It's not. Lonely. If you experience loneliness, that is a sign of the image of God in you. You long for friendships because God created you for relationships. God himself craves relationships. It's intrinsic in his own nature and his own character. In Genesis 1:26, when God is getting ready to create mankind, he says, "Let us make man in our own image." God says, "Let us." God, he goes plural. And this is the first reference, scholars think, theologians think, to the Trinity in the Bible. See, there's this narrative in our culture that says that neediness or loneliness is a character flaw. That autonomy is celebrated. Individualism is considered essential. But the Bible says that even God needs relationship. God is a relationship in and of himself. He exists as Father, Son, and Spirit, each serving one another within what we call the Trinity. See, in Christianity, community relationships are assumed from the very beginning. They're assumed from eternity on. So friendship is rooted in the character of God. The second thing we need to see is that true friendship, Christian friendship, biblical friendship, is covenantal. It's not consumeristic. See, notice Jonathan makes a covenant with David. It says Jonathan made a covenant with David. And he took off his robe, he took off his armor, and he gave it to David. And see, in our world, 21st century New York, we tend to view friendships as a transaction. We end up defining friend so broadly that it actually loses its meaning. We look at people in the ways that they can serve us, and we define friends, and we put friends in categories. So when we meet somebody, we put them in a category and understand sort of how they can help us. So when you're in high school, there's the popular crowd, and you think, if I can be friends with them, they can get me in the in crowd and sort of bolster my popularity. Or this person may be powerful. If I become friends with them, it's called networking. You know, like they work me up the ladder and I get a job. Or they're connected, and so they help us sort of meet other people. Or they're wealthy, and they can sort of provide some sort of, maybe take us out to dinner every now and then. I don't know. Like you put people in these categories of how they can help you. And how we categorize people actually determines how we treat them. So we all have work friends that we treat one way. We have school friends that we treat another way. We have church friends that we treat a certain way. We act a certain way around them that we don't act a way around our other friends. Right? Yeah. Drinking buddies, people say. You have network. You have our network. Professional networks. See, our relationships are almost always tied to some area of our life where that person can serve us in that area. But biblical friendship is not about people serving you, it's about you serving others, even when it's costly to you. Because the difference between a covenant and a consumeristic relationship is that in a covenant, you're committed to the relationship itself, not the benefits of the relationship. So the scriptures say, don't use people. The scriptures say, serve them. Notice that Jonathan did not categorize David. He didn't categorize him in a way that David could be useful to him, because if Jonathan had done that, he never would have been friends with David. He never would have treated David with any kind of respect at all, because here's why. Jonathan is Saul's son. which means Jonathan is next in line for the throne. So if Saul had been successful in murdering David, who becomes king? Or if Saul had been successful murdering David, who becomes king? Jonathan. In fact, Jonathan even has kingly robes on. And when he becomes friends with David, he knows that David was anointed by God and that God had put his spirit upon David. And Jonathan says, "This is my friend. I'm covenanting with him, even if it costs me something." And the Bible even says that Jonathan took off his robes, took off his armor that represented that he was a prince and that would one day be king, and he gives it to David. He literally gives up his future. He gives up power. He gives up prestige to be friends with David. It cost him everything. He honors David as the true king by giving up his rights so that David could be lifted up to the throne. And in that process, he loses the trust of his father, which is a costly move that would threaten his life, because David's not the only person who gets a spear thrown at him in this story. Saul tries to murder Jonathan as well. But the reality is that David needed a friend, and he would not have survived if Jonathan had merely categorized him as if he was some kind of consumer looking for a relationship that would benefit him. Jonathan was a covenantal friend, and it sustained David's life. So when I say friendships are important, I mean friendships are important because it's beneficial for us when we, like David and Jonathan, make ourselves vulnerable to a place where we can have true friends, where we commit ourselves to one another, not the benefits of one another. And it's beneficial for us to make ourselves vulnerable to one another so that we can have deep and lasting friendships. And I'll speak to the men for a moment. I know that it's really difficult for us men at times to be vulnerable and like really have friends. We're kind of used to just having like sports buddies and drinking buddies and work buddies or whatever. That's kind of how men categorize relationships. But the scriptures say that we need deep relationships that are centered around the gospel of Jesus, and that is what unites us. See, listen, men, our wives cannot be our only spiritual friends. Our wives cannot be our only best friend. We need more than sports buddies and work buddies. We need to find godly men in our life to share life with and let them speak into us, let them sharpen us, because it's essential. Men, friendship is more than somebody you share a hobby with. It's someone you share a life with. And I'm not saying that we should all go around making like formal commitments to one another. Like I take off my, and like formally covenant as a friend. Like when you're in elementary school, like, "Will you be my best friend?" We don't do that. This is the only time in the Bible where there's actually a friendship covenant in the Bible. So this isn't like a normative thing. I'm not saying we make like official ceremonies where we become best friends. Although if you want to do that, that's cool. But the principle is that we need committed friends, and we need to be committed friends. We need to be more committed to our relationships than we are the benefits of our relationships. We need to be more committed to serving one another than we are from taking from one another. So friendship is important, but this leads to why the church is important. See, this isn't in the text, but Jesus assumed that this type of friendship would be found within his church. That his church would be defined by people who make covenant relationships to one another. In the New Testament, the idea of a covenant, you only see the idea of a covenant in the New Testament in three ways: marriage, covenant relationship between spouses, God's covenant with his church, and the people of God covenanting with one another to serve God together. This is friendship. This is a covenant. This is the church committing to one another, to love one another, and to serve God. Local Christians covenanting together to live out the gospel with their friendships. Jesus said that the church is a place where people should love one another in such a way that others in the community are drawn into it. Jesus actually said, he said, "People outside of the church will know that I am Lord if you love one another well," speaking to his disciples. The scriptures say that if we as a church do friendship well, if we love one another well, so if those of us in this room are good at loving one another, that it will preach a sermon to our neighborhood that says, there's something about these people, there's a family to them, and they will be drawn into that. They will want to be a part of it. See, the Christian church is facing somewhat of a crisis at the moment. Research shows that people are more spiritual than ever before, but church attendance and church involvement is declining rapidly. I've seen some statistics that say that It's as low as 3% of New Yorkers attend church every Sunday. I don't know if it's that low. Somewhere between 3 and 6%, however. And the Christian church is facing this crisis. People say they're spiritual, they say they're religious, but they're not attached to a community of faith. And I talk to people throughout my week at coffee shops or at the barber shop or wherever, and I always, you know, it's easy for me to have conversations about faith because they say, what do you do for a living? I'm like, oh, I'm a pastor, and then we talk about it. And what I hear all the time, even here in New York, is I hear people say, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I just don't go to church. And George Barna, who does research on this sort of stuff, he says people are becoming more and more and more immune to the idea of doing church, quote, on their own. And I kind of get it. Like, I understand what's going on there. A lot of people have been hurt by the church, or a lot of people have gone to churches that are just lifeless or boring or whatever. But this idea that I can be a Christian but yet not be connected to Jesus's church, this idea that you can follow Jesus but not be a part of his church, that's foreign to the New Testament. And it's a dangerous idea to think that you can be a faithful follower of Jesus without committing to Jesus's church. See, this is actually a type of Christianity that would be unrecognizable to Jesus. And it would be unrecognizable to the early Christians as well, aside from the fact that it's offensive to Jesus. Jesus refers to the local church as his bride in the scriptures. So for you to say, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church, that's like you saying, Will, I really like you, but I'm not a big fan of your wife. Okay, like our friendship ends at that moment. Like it's a package deal. Like, I mean, it's my wife, you know? I almost said my wife. Okay, sorry. It came out weird. All right, come back, Will. Did I just reference Borat? What's wrong with me? You cannot say you love Jesus, but you dislike his wife. You can't do that. You can't do that. And see, our understanding of the church and our culture, the reason why people can say I'm a Christian, but I'm not a part of Christ's church, is because even Christianity has fallen into this trap of consumerism in the United States. See, people come to church often to consume sermons, to consume music, to consume childcare so they can get an hour and a half to themselves or whatever. So people consume the church, they use the church, come give me a sermon, give me a song so that I can be lifted up and go out for the week. But then churches also use people. Come on, give your money so that we can do the things we want to do. And sit in the seat so that we can have people to do it in front of. Both of these are wrong. When you consume the church, or when the church consumes you, the church is not existing as God designed it. The church was designed to exist as a covenant community where we all together sharpen one another and befriend one another in a way that provides and cares and shepherds for each of our lives and shows the outside world that there's something to this Jesus thing. During our Building a Common Vision meetings, where we've been sort of working through what our mission statement is as a church, we were discussing this idea of family. Everybody was saying, I want our church to be a family. And we were talking about this idea of family, and one of the questions that came up is, you know, how do we cultivate this idea of family within the church? And one of the people at my table said, the mission of our church ought to be to love one another so well that our non-Christian neighbors want to be a part of our family. That's a vision, and that's a mission for what our church can be. And so how do you cultivate these friendships within the church? You come on Sunday, there's people around. How do you turn that into deep, lasting friendships? And there's a lot of ways. Join a small group where you can hang out with people during the week and study the scriptures together. Join a volunteer team. We need people to come at 8 a.m. and help us set up in the mornings, in the equipment and everything. Come and set up and you hang out with one another while we do that. Join a volunteer team. You know that awkward time where we shake everybody's hands? You know, and it's like, hey, everybody shake hands, like while the kids run to their classrooms. That's not just like filler time. The point of that is that so you guys can exchange numbers and hang out with each other after church. Well, you want to know a way to develop a friendship today when church is over? Find somebody that you've never really hung out with and say, hey, let's go out to lunch. I'll buy your lunch. That's one way to develop a relationship. Show up late. Show up early to church. Don't show up late. You already do that. Do something different. Show up early. Stay late. Hang out and eat bagels after service. Listen, if Joe Dykema is on hospitality again, you better stay late because the dude crushed some awesome scones last week. So next time he's on the team, eat some scones and hang out with people. Today, I think Nancy put a great spread out as well. Those snacks are there so that we'll hang out together and get to know one another after the service. If you want, join Celebrate Recovery, what that Jenny talked about. That's where we make relationships. If you want to experience all that God has for you and all that this church has to offer, you must develop relationships. There's a story in Exodus chapter 17, and I've told this several times before because it's such a beautiful story, where Moses is leading the people of Israel, and the Amalekites come in. These are the bad guys or whatever, and they're coming in, and they're about to attack God's people, the people of Israel. And God tells Moses, he says, Moses, if your arms are lifted up, Israel will be winning the battle. If you lift your staff up in the air, Israel will win the battle. But if your staff is lowered, then the Amalekites will be winning the battle. And so Moses goes up on top of the mountain while the battle is happening. He raises up his staff in the air, and he's holding it up, and Israel's just dominating. It's awesome. But all of a sudden, his arms start to get tired, which, you know, in high school or whatever, your like basketball coach would make you hold your arms up for punishment or whatever. His arms start to drop. And as his arms dropped, the people of Israel started losing. And one of Moses' friends, Aaron, and his friend Hur, they saw this happening. And so they come off the battlefield, they come up to Moses, they sit him down on a rock, and they both stand on each side and they hold up his arms until the battle is over. And that is a beautiful picture of what friendship looks like in the kingdom of God. Because there's often times in your life where you're winning your battles. And there's often times where you feel like you are losing your battles. And what you need most in those days when you are losing is someone to come and metaphorically raise your arms up so you can win that. Because you will face battles in this life that you cannot face alone. And you need Christian community to come and raise your arms up so that you can fight that battle. This is why we believe that it's important for everyone to be involved. Because songs and sermons aren't enough to experience all that God has for you. Join us in community. Let us raise your arms when you're weak. Raise our arms when we are weak. And I end today, like all the stories of the Bible, this narrative points further than beyond just a story of having friends. We talked about this last week. There's the subplot of this story, which is friendship, the importance of friendship. But the main plot is always Jesus. And there's this passage in John chapter 15. Jesus said, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than someone lay down his life for his friends." He says, "You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you." Jesus, one of the names that he's given in the New Testament is Friend of Sinners. It's the name of Jesus, Friend of Sinners. And Jonathan, in this story, sort of the subplot, is that Jonathan is a good friend to David, and there's a lot we can learn from that. But the main plot is that Jonathan is a shadow of what true friendship is, and Jesus is the perfect model of what friendship looks like. Because friendship, Jesus says, is most clearly seen when someone lays down their life for their friends. And so that means that friendship, there's no greater love in this world than that moment when Jesus laid down on a cross and had his arms and his legs nailed to it so that he could die for his friends, meaning you and I, so that we could be called friends of God. And in this story today, Jonathan sacrifices his opportunity to be king so that David could live and become king. And that is a shadow of what Jesus has done for us. Jesus is the true king, sitting at the right hand of the Father. He is the King of kings and Lord of lords, yet he takes off his kingly robes and is stripped naked. He removes his crown and he's replaced with a crown of thorns that's pressed onto his head, deep into his flesh and in his skull. He lays aside his sword and receives a spear to the side. Jesus laid down everything so that we could receive everything. Jesus took off his robe so that we could be clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And on the cross, Jesus forfeited his kingship so that we could be called kings, or as Jenny said, children of God, his favorite kids. 2 Corinthians 8:9 says, "Though he was rich, for our sake Jesus became poor, so that by his poverty we might become rich." And if David in any way benefited from Jonathan's friendship, how much more so do we benefit from Jesus' friendship to us? See, a true friend always has open arms for the people they care about. And Timothy Keller, who pastors not far from here on the Upper West Side, says a true friend opens their arms for one another. But Jesus' friends weren't simply held open to demonstrate his love for us. They were nailed open. Romans 5:8 says that God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were yet sinners. Translation, while we were God's enemies, Christ died for us. That's a sacrifice much greater than Jonathan taking off his kingly robes and forfeiting an earthly throne. Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself so that we could be lifted high. And then Jesus calls us to do the same. He says, as I've been to you, I want you to be to others. Commit yourself to the good of those in your family. Commit yourself to the good of those in your church. Commit yourself to the good of those in your neighborhood, because that is what Christ did for you, even when it's costly. Even when it costs time, even when it costs emotional energy, even when it costs you your reputation to love others, you do it because that's what Christ did. See, we need friends, and if the church is working properly, the church is where we find friendship. And then we're then empowered to live out these friendships by the example of Jesus. Eugene Peterson, and I'll close with this. Eugene Peterson says that friendship is a much underestimated aspect of spirituality. It's every bit as significant as prayer and fasting. Like the sacramental use of water and bread and wine, friendship takes what is common in human experience and turns it into something holy. Friendship with David complicated Jonathan's life enormously. Jonathan risked losing his father's favor and willingly sacrificed his own royal future. But neither the risk nor the loss deterred him. He became and stayed David's friend. Jonathan's friendship was an essential to David's life. And it's highly unlikely that David could have persisted in serving Saul without the friendship of Jonathan. But Jonathan, in striking contrast to his father, discerned God in David. He comprehended the danger and the difficulty of his anointing, and he made a covenant of friendship with David. And Jonathan's friendship entered David's soul in a way that Saul's hatred never did. And in your life, there's all these things that enter into your soul that get at you and irk at you, whether it's depression or anxiety or insecurity or loneliness or fear or addiction or whatever it is. They have a way to creep into your soul. But the testimony of the scriptures is that good, godly community can reach much deeper and can help protect you when those enemies come creeping in. Like Jonathan and David, Jesus' covenant with us cost him everything. But if we enter into a covenant with Jesus by following him, the scriptures say we gain everything. Let's pray.